Yeah, he's our favorite nerd. Keeping your technology running smoothly, here's Benjamin Rockwell with Computer Talk Radio.
Tons in store for you this week here on Computer Talk Radio. We're going to talk with Keith about, yes, the upcoming Worldwide Developers Conference, rumors, Apple, a number of different things that we're going to hit on that particular item. Marty's going to talk about the Ricoh 6500 Lumen 4K project, 6500 lumens. And it's a big one. Steve Kesky's going to talk about the Webb Telescope. And we've got listener questions as well. Trevor wants to know, how does Google Maps know that traffic is building up in real time? Mateo, why do we need to update our software so often? On the IT Pro series, the next level of interviewing may be worse than ever before. And then the scam series, I've got another near scam of in-app purchases. I'm also going to be talking about how kiosks are going to be bringing digital discrimination. Well, no, they have been for quite a while, and it's an ugly area. Mark Brownstein is going to be joining me. He's a professional with a vast background in user interfaces, and we'll talk about that. Of course, if you miss any of that on this week's Computer Talk Radio, please feel free to check out the podcast at ComputerTalkRadio.com, ComputerTalkRadio.com. The phone number, by the way, 888-NERD-888. That's 888-637-3888. And you can reach me with your computer questions, your technology concerns, in either location. I'm here to help. Let's dive into the news from the past week. And the Nintendo Switch number 2, or version 2, or whatever you want to call it, Nintendo Switch 2, it was released to the public this last week with a return to stories of yesteryear, where people were lining up, clamoring to get their hands on one of these through stores and more. This represents quite a bit of a difference since the last release was 8 years ago. So let's go through. Larger display, better resolution, including 4K resolution when it's sitting in the dock. There's more memory, a new processor. Look, the list goes on. Again, it's 8 years. And, of course, it's 8 years, so there's going to be a price shift. How much? $150 more than the original. So you'll want to plan for buying some accessories and some new games. So the base price of $449 is really a starting point. Still, many people do love Nintendo, and this is no different. Now, the story keeps repeating. SpaceX sends up a rocket and another one and another one. And along the way, some of them go boom and they blow up. And I mentioned this concept a little while, but over the course of the last, just over a week ago, we had one of these rockets go up and it went boom. But a lot of editorials have been coming out. It's becoming more and more clear across those that follow this effort that when rockets go boom in many other companies, it's a problem. It's not a problem for SpaceX. They're following a different path from the entire rest of the industry. Their approach, which they don't seem to publicize this, but it appears to be frequent, inexpensive builds and rapid adjustments to fix what went wrong last time. For every failure, they adapt, they grow, they put more into space than anyone else. And it's this concept, you've heard of this before all of the time, go big or go home. And that seems to be their rallying cry with cheers of success, even as they break things or make fireworks. So it's very similar to how programmers work and innovators, the adventurous and the bold. So don't dismiss these ideas. Oh, it blew up. It's a failure for SpaceX. No, they're definitely learning. Now, for a while, we've seen the usage of the EM dash being talked about as a way to identify AI, artificial intelligence. And oddly enough, there are defenders of this. They say that in their standard writing, that the most literate amongst us will use it frequently. I'm going to push back on that. I'm going to say, look, the ability to create an M-dash readily is just a little bit harder than the standard called N-dash. The M-dash is that wider hyphen. It's almost twice as wide, and the N-dash is the normal hyphen. So to do the M-dash, you have to use Control-Alt-Minus. And on the Mac, it's Option-Minus versus just hitting the minus sign. So in all of the writing that I've seen over the years, I have seen it in journalism here and there. That's because it's a weird kind of journalistic business, high-end, not even business English, just fanciful writing option that's there. But I've rarely seen it in journalism, non-existent in business. So perhaps it's an indicator, but it's also like odd word choices or prose that's far above the level of the author's capabilities. And you've got to put all of these things together versus just saying, oh, there's an M-dash, it's AI, and just dismissing it out of hand. So Amazon, they made a giant claim about their tech in their Fresh stores, Amazon Fresh, called Just Walk Out. And you would go and you'd drop something into your cart, and then you'd drop something more, and supposedly it was AI. Well, it was uncovered a bit over a year ago. It was 1,000 techs off in India. Fast forward to this week, where a startup called Builder AI had a revelation. They've been around for about 6 years, where it was once valued at $1.5 billion, and it was publicly backed by Microsoft. The curtain fell as they declared bankruptcy. The AI-powered tool wasn't really based on artificial intelligence, but instead, yep, you've heard it before, 700 employees, humans, scrambling quickly to respond as if they were AI chatbots, generating code and whatnot as those responses. Yeah, that's right. As things start building, we're going to see more and more companies utilizing deception that push ideas of power and greatness, but yet they will devolve into ruin when the truth of when the truth arrives. So look, I'm going to tell you, this isn't a big surprise to me. We also saw some additional information similar to that with China's big, huge AI search engine, which was supposed to be highly efficient and on a much smaller platform. And as news came out, oh, it was bigger than that, a lot bigger than that. So I'm not surprised. We're going to see this kind of, it's not a scam, but it is scamming investors. So maybe it is. I don't know. There is a new advertising campaign, kind of a push, that has arrived. And it is a little bit of a grassroots effort. It's built on the premise that you do not need to follow the prescribed path towards Microsoft's Windows 11. It's called End of 10. And it's built on the resistance to arbitrary requirements, the disposal of perfectly good hardware, and yes, what is a behemoth? Microsoft. Now, resistance usually comes in the form of a very small amount of people, very small groups, and this is no different. They're giving us an option, and it's no surprise that that option, that other alternative operating system, would be Linux. Now, at the same time, Linux is about twice the install base of 2 years ago. The current number, it's about 4.5%, which is one of the highest stats that we've seen from Linux on StatCounter. I utilize StatCounter as the basic idea of how many people are utilizing operating systems or browsers or whatever else out there. They're pretty much reliable with that. Everybody else does. So to be clear, if you want to go down to the Linux road, there is a journey available, and in it, there is a level of an effort that you will have to undertake if you go in this direction. They're trying to promote this. They're trying to connect you with people, and it's only listing a few locations in the United States that are signed on to help right now, but it is an idea to consider. Now, for 8 months last year, a teenager in Texas, Siddharth Nandalia, worked on a new app to find heart problems at an early stage. Usually these issues would pop up after a stroke or heart attack, but his app, it's an app, Yeah, it skips over the usual echocardiograms, blood tests, and other high-end expensive approaches. In his case, it's being done via smartphone, and it's apparently quite successful at 96% accuracy. Now, don't get this kid wrong. He is a brainiac. At 11, he designed a prosthetic arm that goes for about $150 in India. At 13, an armband that detects falls for the elderly at a higher accuracy than the Apple Watch. And at 14, he's a freshman at the University of Texas. His plans are actually to continue with this same concept from the heart over to the lungs. He's definitely a young person to watch. Coming up next, we're going to talk about user interfaces with Mark Brownstein here on Computer Talk Radio.
Let's talk about on and off.
You mean like light switches?
Yeah, the original user interface device.
And you were there, right?
Hey, I'm not that old.
Yeah, you are. So on and off.
Yeah, only with no humans doing it, like...
going down.
But you and I both have our computers on CyberPower UPS systems.
Yeah, so we have power, but there's another on and off.
Oh, right. Online and offline.
You got it. Meaning another UPS at the cable modem and VoIP phone and Wi-Fi router.
And even a low-cost standby UPS can handle those. Better, of course, if it has AVR.
Right, so it doesn't have to hit the battery just because the line voltage drops.
Maybe it's a good time to mention the promo that saves $10 to $15. Details are at the CyberPower website.
And maybe you could put it on your website?
Oh, that's already done at ComputerTalkRadio.com.
You know, on and off, you take really good care of your listeners.
Website, ComputerTalkRadio.com, ComputerTalkRadio.com. That's how you can reach out to us. Scroll down to where it says contact us today. We will answer your computer questions, your technology concerns, whatever they may be. And one of the technology concerns that people have talked about in recent days, we talk about user experience and user interfaces. And there's a lot of different things that go along with this. And I decided I'd bring on Mark Brownstein. Mark Brownstein has an extensive history in all kinds of different user experiences because you've been in the industry for as long as Marty's been in the industry, a little bit longer than I have. But there's just so much there. Mark Brownstein. Give me actually, if you would, please, just a quick background of where you come from.
Actually, I've been in the industry longer than Marty has. He was doing public relations when I was supervising the keyboard department of a major cancer study group in the late 70s. Oh, wow. And the operators decided they can't do certain things on their Xerox 850 keyboards. And so I took it upon myself to learn how to do these things, and I showed them how to do it. So after I left them, I started a word processing business.
Yeah.
And my tagline was, we'll make your small business look like a big business because the documentation looks a lot better. Back then, you know, you had to be a big business to own the word processing equipment and to have operators run it. So that lasted a little bit. And while I was doing that, I got interested in writing. So I submitted articles all over the place and they were accepted. Mm-hmm. So from there, I went to video games magazines, and from that, I got launched into a lot of editorial, and I wrote a couple of books and got my job at InfoWorld, and I was there not as long as I'd have liked to have been,
but
I reviewed a lot of interface products, a lot of keyboards, things that I really had an interest in, keyboards and mice and joysticks and all kinds of products. So that's where I was. Since then, I've been at computer storage magazines. I've done still a lot of reviews for a lot of other magazines. So that's where I am right now.
So a user interface, and you kind of touched on that right there, talking about the keyboards and the mice. And actually, one of the things that you and I have in common, a fondness for trackballs. I've got a Kensington sitting over there right now. I do use it every once in a while. Beautiful.
With a big red ball on it, right?
Yes, yes. You know the one.
I know the one. I've used it until it ran out of steam, and then I got another one. Then I went to a Logitech.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah. Great, great and, company, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I went to that. Now I'm using a mouse because I found still a little bit better control, and I'm running it on my right knee.
Okay, there you go.
The mouse
yeah,
pad.
Yeah, yeah.
But it works. My keyboard is sitting a little to the left of the knee, and it's fine until it drops off my knee, and I've got to go fish it out.
I totally get that. I've done that before in the past. I've definitely kicked back and used the mouse on my leg, and great stuff. But now that brings us into that user interface. There's a lot of different user interfaces. We don't we don't always think about them. It's how we, you and I and the listeners, interact with the computers. We're starting to move away from, yes, the keyboard and the mouse into these voice interfaces like Siri and Alexa and so forth. I don't like that idea. A lot of people propose that idea for business. I can't imagine being in a room with 100 people all yelling at their machine, you know, type this out or whatever.
I was at a conference a few years ago where the speaker concluded that for the flexibility of giving up, you know, hey, Google, what time is it? You're giving up your privacy.
It's a matter of
how much is it worth to you to give up your privacy and have this thing give you the time of day.
Yeah, it is definitely one of those things which has been a growing concern. And it doesn't matter whether we're talking about Google or we're talking about Amazon or any of these different companies. We're starting to they're studying us. They want to know how to better serve us.
Oh, yeah.
Just like the Twilight Zone, how to serve man. Chills up, yeah. Chills up and down my spine for that one. Along the way, what are some of the different user interface experiences that have excited you, and what are some of the ones that have bored you, just said, no, I don't like this or whatever?
Experience I had all over the place is with my phone. I've had different devices with user interfaces, and I've had confusion about them. My phone, I push a button, I push the screen. I can move the screen up. I could slide to a next screen. I do this kind of stuff with my finger.
Mm-hmm.
My microwave oven, same thing. I push the button for how much time, what temperature, those kinds of things, and I press start. I have a refrigerator that does the same thing. I push the button, the ice maker comes on. And then again, you've got other devices with different interfaces.
Mm-hmm.
I have a dishwasher. Dishwasher has a strip on top of the control step. I couldn't get it to work. I thought, okay, it's capacitive, so it's going to know when I touch it.
Mm-hmm.
And by accident, I pushed it and pushed it down and found a switch under there. Mm-hmm. I was just about to call technical support because the thing didn't work. I have a thing called a Plod note pin. I think Marty reviewed this a few weeks ago.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
And it's a small device. It fits on the wrist, or you can put it with a magnet on your shirt or coat or something, and I could not get it to work. They say, well, push the button on it, and it looked like there was no button to push. It's just a gray panel on the top. And I eventually realized I push down a little bit and hold it, and it'll work. So the point I'm trying to make here is that you've got to know what kind of interface you're working with. Some you have to push. And on my phone, I have to do that. I have to push a button to make the volume go up or down.
Sure,
I have to push a button, hold something else to turn it off. Mm-hmm. But I don't think about those things. I expect if I see it, I'm going to touch it and it's going to work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think other users probably go through the same process of trying to figure out why it doesn't work, what they've done wrong, and maybe they've done nothing wrong. They just didn't know to hold down a button. But for me, it's confusing. And if it's confusing to me, it might be confusing to other people. And so this is why I'm bringing it up.
You know, I bring another parallel to this. So I have a remote for one of my AV equipment items in my living room. And I've gotten to the point where I press the button and I feel the click of the button, but I it doesn't take. So I hit it again, and I know I'm squeezing it harder every time I do it, even though I know the button's taking. It's just a matter of the infrared going from the remote to the system. And that's something we shouldn't be doing. It's like you're speaking to somebody in a different language, and all of a sudden, you're raising your voice. Don't you understand what I'm saying? And we need to get away from that. We all need to get away from doing that.
It's like pushing the elevator button. You think that the more you push it, the faster it's going to get there. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
It's like you push the button, you wait for something to happen. I do that too. If there's something between my remote control and the TV I'm trying to control, doesn't happen. I have to remember to lift it above the signal so that it goes through.
Definitely.
So these are the kinds of things that we know maybe to do, but we're frustrated by these things because they don't work as we expect them to.
Definitely. So that's the voice of Mark Brownstein. He's an expert on these user interfaces, has been for a long time. We're going to have you back, cover some more stuff here in the future. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. You are listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment.
Micro Center, home to all kinds of electronics and computer items, has over 20 locations across the country, and it's also available at microcenter.com. This is Benjamin Rockwell of Computer Talk Radio, and I live just a couple of miles away from my local Micro Center, and I've been shopping there for years. From Apple to Windows, they've got what you need. CPUs, got them. Screwdrivers and other tools, yep. Cables, televisions, scanners, projectors, cameras, they have it all. Micro Center is a place which fills your electronic needs. What are you looking for? Media centers, monitors, mice, MP3 players, media, modems, motherboards, memory? Those are just the M's. They aren't regional, but spread across our great land from Virginia to California. Each one is service and repair, in-store clinics, and business services, too. MicroCenter.com is their online store, a place where you can get your regular online ordering needs met. From the hobbyist to the professional, the brand name, or building it yourself, MicroCenter is your resource. Check out MicroCenter.com today. MicroCenter.com.
Website, ComputerTalkRadio.com, ComputerTalkRadio.com. That is just one of the ways you can reach out to us. We will answer your computer questions, your technology concerns. We're interested in ensuring that you are kept up to date with all of computers, technology, all of that. And one of the things that, so we're going to spend the next few minutes here with Keith M. Cedar, but I want to give you kind of a heads up. Next week, we're going to be talking about WWDC 25. That is the Apple Worldwide Developers Conference. And in that, there is a lot of just an amazing amount of announcements every year. And one of the things that Keith wanted to talk to is some years we think of it as absolutely amazing, but some years it's a snooze fest. And for Keith, a lot of it is because, well, Keith, I think you get spoiled by a lot of the rumors. We don't talk about the rumors here on the show, but a lot of the different things get leaked out. A lot of the things we know about this all in advance.
Yeah, Benjamin, the rumor mill, or as we like to call it in the computer journalism space, speculative journalism.
Yes.
It's actually very big with a lot of Apple broadcasters, but you know, we like to be a little more fact-based here at Computer Talk Radio. So we really don't engage in that. We kind of wait for Apple to do what they're going to do and introduce what they're going to introduce. Because the reality of it is you could have all the rumors in the world, and until Apple actually says, hey, here's our new thing that does this, this, and this, and here's when it's going to be available, it's not real. And so we don't really waste our time with that here on this show. But the-
from memory, from the rumor mill over the years, I don't think you have a scientific number, but no. What would you say is the accuracy of the rumor mill? Are we up to 50% accuracy? Is it even that high?
These days, I would say 50 to 75%, depending upon the year. But here's really what it comes down to for me, Benjamin. You and I have been doing this show together, and specifically this segment, for over a decade now. And it's been a lot of fun, and we've shared a lot of information with our listeners, and it's been beneficial for everybody involved. But every time you and I get together and get on a microphone, right after the Worldwide Developers Conference keynote year over year, the first thing you say to me is, hey, what did you think? Was it exciting? And
evolutionary or revolutionary was a lot of what the terms we use. Yeah.
But really what it comes down to is, over the last how many keynotes, Benjamin, would you say that my response to the keynote was lackluster?
So let's take it across all of the keynotes, not just the WWDC. Announcements, because that's how I think of it. I'm going to say over the course of the last 5 years, you've probably called three of them. And this is across all of the different. So we've got something in September. Usually we've got something that's usually in the February, March time frame. Sometimes we have an October. I'm going to say three of them where you've said this is revolutionary, maybe four. Right. I called you on one of them and I said, no, it's not revolutionary.
Bottom line is I was excited about them.
Yeah.
But the reality of it is, more often than not, I'm going to say at this point in time, more like 70 to 80%, I have been completely nonplussed, completely unenthused or excited by the keynotes. And that has been largely because of the vast number of leaks ahead of the keynote that turned out to be true. You know, and even if the level of verity of those rumors, you know, was only at 75, 80, 90%, the reality of it is, you know, it's like yelling spoiler alert when you're going to watch a movie or get a new book.
So,
and I'm not excited about these things anymore. And I want to be excited. I mean, it's like, imagine if Santa Claus came and told you what you were going to get and said, okay, we'll see the presents under the tree in the morning.
So now I'm going to go back to your numbers. So you said 50 to 75%. Now I'm going to take a little exception. I think of the things that they announced that were in the rumor mill, I think, yes, 75% that was delivered, we knew about. Now, and maybe even a little bit more. I'm going to say, on the other hand, there's a lot of things that we've heard in the rumor mill that never showed up. And we wound up, I mean, there's a lot of things. So I would drive that number lower.
The only one that really jumps out at me is the Apple television. You know, you got the Apple TV box, but it was rumored for a long time to be an Apple television.
Yeah.
That was the only one that was really vaporware that I'd wanted. But my point is that so many leaks that are so true a week or two before the keynote, there's no way with the level of secrecy that Apple portends to have that they're not being, you know, leaked on purpose. I mean, Steve Jobs over a decade ago famously said, who ever heard of a ship that leaks from the top? Right?
Right. Yeah.
So the reality of it is that Apple's got to do something about making sure there are no more leaks. Because you know what? These keynotes aren't fun for me anymore. And would you always call me when we first started the consummate Apple fanboy? Maybe I was.
Still are.
Maybe I'd like to be again. But the reality of it is I'm a bit more of a pragmatist about this, Benjamin. And I want to be surprised. I mean, we already, you know about the rumors about the change in the operating system numbers. and there's such grandiose talk about it, it probably will turn out to be true. But we don't know yet. We'll find out. Because the next time we talk, we will have seen the keynote.
Yeah. And it's one of those situations where you're going to watch it. I do the fast forward watch through the keynotes. Especially WWDC, I pay a little bit more attention to that one because there's a little bit more information there. Mm-hmm. Some of the product announcements recently, especially if I knew in advance they were boring.
Mm-hmm.
It was a matter of, okay, I'll catch the Cliff Notes version.
Yeah. Or you'll get it from Keith.
Yeah, exactly. So there is what we've got. That's what we're going to be talking about next week. We're going to, of course, devote a little extra time for Keith to tell us all about what's happening in Cupertino. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell.
And I'm Keith M. Seador.
You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment.
Hi, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Most of us use digital cameras nowadays, but what do we do with those old pictures and slides in the back of the closet? Well, let me tell you about Legacy Digital Productions. They specialize in taking your old memories on film, videotape, and slides and digitizing them to DVDs. If you have boxes of old slides, then you know they fade more and more each year. Let Legacy Digital scan them for you and stop the aging process dead in its tracks. You'll get beautiful 10-megapixel digital files, color-corrected and ready for printing. All this is done faster and cheaper than buying a film scanner and doing it yourself. Your files are then burned onto gold archival DVD discs where they will last for generations. Call right now, mention my name, Benjamin Rockwell, and receive a 30% discount on your order. Call toll-free 1-866-2-LEGACY. That's 1-866-2-LEGACY. And tell them Benjamin sent you. Your memories are priceless, so call 866-2-LEGACY now.
The website, ComputerTalkRadio.com, ComputerTalkRadio.com. That's how you can reach out to us. Scroll down to where it says contact us today. You can also check out the podcast there, whatever you want to do. It's just a great way to follow up on Computer Talk Radio. Marty Winston joins me now, and what do you
I want to project an impression.
I was trying to find a pun just like that, the dad joke rather. Just lead into that. Go ahead, project
as
away.
If telepathy didn't work between us by now. How long have we been on the air together?
It's been a while. It's been quite a while. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, not to over magnify the subject. Everyone remembers Ricoh, right? R-I-C-O-H. I knew them mm-hmm. early on for copiers and printers.
Yes, and scanners
Yeah, they're all over office stuff. What they just sent me, I have to say, I see more video projectors than most people. This is one of the most impressive projectors I've seen in a long time.
Okay.
And I'm going to give a first impression now, but I know I want to revisit this in a future segment.
Okay.
It's their UHL-3660.
Okay.
Let's start by talking about the brightness. 6,500 lumens.
All right. That's distinctly bright. That is, having dealt with projectors in churches for a long time, in a normal church, we look for somewhere around 3,500 to 4,500. So 6,500 lumens. That's bright. Yeah.
And look, for those guys who don't go to church to watch projectors, it's the same brightness as 8 classic filament-powered 60-watt bulbs.
Okay.
All right? So it's got some brightness.
Yeah.
It's 6,500 lumens. It is 4K ultra-high def.
Okay, nice. All right. Now, that's some serious stuff there because I know that we started seeing a little bit of 4K recently. It's taken a long time for them to do 4K projectors. Everybody.
It has, and there are more coming out, and we'll do some things about the projector industry later.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to point out ultra-short throw lens here.
Okay.
I can take it to my living room, which mm-hmm. does not have screen bright wallpaper.
Uh-huh.
It's yeah. kind of dingy old stuff. I can turn this thing on with the room lights on
mm-hmm.
and watch grainy old black and white movies in the middle of the day, and they are as vivid as a dark theater.
Okay, nice.
Oh, and believe me, the black and white movies are only to kill time until the color stuff comes on. So it's true 4K, ultra mm-hmm. high def.
Yeah.
3840 by 2160.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
But let's go to the next level of specs that you guys normally wouldn't be dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
10-bit color.
Okay. That's
extra color depth and HDR, high dynamic range. So if you're in a scene where there's a sun glare or a bomb blowing up or a whole burst of white,
mm-hmm.
that difference comes through to your eyeballs like
okay.
real life.
Nice.
Okay.
Nice.
I mean, it's important. 6,500 lumens is more than six times brighter than cheap projectors, more
sure,
than triple
yeah.
the brightness of most of the world's other 4K projectors. Now, they use a technology called laser phosphor. And laser phosphor
okay.
uses a laser to excite a phosphor ring. Comes at a really high temperature in there. But that's how you get your spot two-color system that breaks into the three to four colors, depending on how you look at it,
okay.
that creates
mm-hmm.
the image.
Mm-hmm.
There's a ton of laser energy focused on a very small spot on that ring to okay. get that to happen. And it is one of the cleverest ways to light a projector in decades. It's not new with these guys, but it's really done to a fairly well in this projector.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that laser phosphor light source is rated at, in normal mode, 20,000 hours life expectancy.
Okay, all right.
Want to use the eco mode? 40,000 hours. 20,000 hours is 2 years and 3 months if you're running it 24/7, and you're not.
No. You run it for you know, a few hours. You watch Lord of the Rings, however many. what is that? Like 8,000 times or something?
Yeah, right. And there's a Star Wars: Revenge of the Careers, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
It has two HDMI inputs, plus mm-hmm. a network input and HD base T, and Miracast for wireless mm-hmm. projection from Windows or Android.
Mm-hmm.
The ultra-short lens, you may see that as UST, means that from 18 to 34 inches away,
wow.
you can project images from roughly 84 to 160 inches diagonal measure. It weighs about 25 pounds. It costs about $6,000 online. I'll tell you more later. Okay.
All right. I'm looking forward to catching up after you get a deeper dive into this. That'll be very interesting. As for now, Marty Winston is the voice on the other end. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment. Years ago, I found a web hosting company that fit my needs as a computer nerd, as a radio show host, and just a normal person. Recently, though, it was clear to me that it was time to upgrade, but I had a choice between my old plan and the new one at seven times the cost. It was that awkward point where I could choose between a sip of water or being dunked in a pool. I searched around, comparing the many options for someone like me. After searching around for 3 weeks, there it was, SiteGround. In proper fashion, I tested their customer service, their knowledge, and their willingness to do things the right way. The site ground salesman made sure that I didn't overbuy and get a 50-gallon bucket when a 32-ounce soda would do. These guys know WordPress, Joomla, and regular standard websites. These guys at SiteGround are awesome. SiteGround.com. Site, S-I-T-E, ground.com. My tagline always goes, the bad guys are out to get us. They're out to get you, me, and everybody they can. However, I want to address for a moment something that isn't so much necessarily a bad guy, but I feel like it is a bad practice. And one of these bad practices is the idea of in-app purchases in mobile games. And sure, you're going along, you're playing a game, and you're trying to get through it, and you're struggling, and they give you an offer. Hey, you can get an extra few coins, you can get an extra big, huge weapon, or whatever it is, and they lure you in, and it's only going to be a dollar or so, and you say, fine, maybe it's $2, maybe it's $3, but here's the thing, they are making a ton of money doing this. And why? For what? So you can be entertained? Now, don't get me wrong. If you want to buy a $5 game, you want to buy a $10 game. Maybe you've got something, you know, some of these, Class A games. We're talking about things like Cities Skylines or Planet Coaster 2 or whatever first-person shooter you like to play. Sure, those are $50. But you shouldn't be buying a game and then continually paying little small amounts to continue playing that game. I struggle with that all the way along. See, these small purchases, they can add up quickly. They're offering, hey, I mean, just in that little mobile gaming experience, hey, just pay an extra dollar and you'll get past this particular hurdle. Well, then a couple of days later, you're paying another dollar again. And a week later, you're going to pay another dollar again. And then another couple of days go by and another dollar, and this racks up. And you can be paying $5, $10, $15 in a month to play a quote-unquote free game. And I struggle with this concept because this really turns into a pay-to-win, or at least pay-to-cheat model. And all of this spending will, yeah, drive you broke. Worse yet, children and anybody who has kind of an addictive tendency is going to be particularly susceptible to these in-app purchase prompts. And that is where I start struggling more and more. Another area is the lack of transparency, because they're not telling you you're going to succeed, but you're being given tools that might help you do better. Okay, so you buy a tool, and then you buy another tool, and then you buy another tool. And you know what, at this rate, you might as well just sit and hang out at the local Home Depot, because you're buying all of these tools. Look, it's a bad idea, especially since you can't get refunds. This is money that just keeps going out, and you've got nothing tangible for this. You've got nothing to hold in your hand or anything like that. And this encouragement of continuous spending, this incentivizing you to continue ongoing purchases to maintain progress or get new content or any of this, just really does not feel good to me. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Let me tell you about The Radio Factory, an exciting new venue for talk radio. It's the internet, the wave of the present. My name is Benjamin Rockwell, and I'm the host of a syndicated radio program, Computer Talk Radio. So I know the internet is here and now. Many of the hosts at theradiofactory.com have their own podcasts or radio shows across the country. But many people like the comfort of listening to their own special radio show at a specific time and day, much like we watch live television. The internet, as you're probably aware, is a powerful tool that allows The Radio Factory to deliver unique programming with far more variety than the windbags who are simply about contriving up viewpoints to get you riled up. Additionally, you'll find that many of the programs are shorter, giving more information in less time. Stick with theradiofactory.com and see how it evolves to keep you entertained, interested, informed, and above all, intelligent. After all, the Radio Factory motto is building your intelligence one talk show at a time. TheRadioFactory.com.
Gigabyte, kilobyte, terabyte, megabyte, all this stuff makes my brain megahertz. Fortunately, someone is available to explain all this technobabble, helping you make sense of technology. Here's Benjamin Rockwell with Computer Talk Radio.
We are halfway through this week's Computer Talk Radio. This is radio's broadest look at computers, technology, and how they impact you, me, and all of our lives. The website, ComputerTalkRadio.com, ComputerTalkRadio.com. The phone number, 888-NERD, 888, that's 888-6373-888. Making good on our promise of radio's broadest look at computers, technology, and how they impact us, Steve Keske joins me now. Steve, what do you have for us this week?
Web.
Web?
W-E-B.
The World Wide Web? What?
The telescope.
You did say two B's at the end, didn't you? Okay.
Yeah.
The Web Telescope. All right. Yeah, go on.
Well, we know that we put up Hubble a while ago. Mm-hmm. Can't exactly know when. But Hubble only looks at visible light.
Yes.
And there's a whole lot of spaces out there that look black.
Yes.
That look empty.
Yes.
According to Hubble. Well, when they turned Webb on, which uses infrared, it did a little clue, and it turned to those little dark spots and said, these aren't spots, are not empty, guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They are full. So there are stars and galaxies, and there are probably about 10 times more than we ever thought they were.
Mm-hmm.
And Webb actually photographed two galaxies coming together.
Yeah.
Which I thought was absolutely fabulous. They had never seen that before. But infrared says, hey, that's what's happening out there. These two galaxies are, you know, stripping each other, you know, from whole solar systems. Planet.
Sure, stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, and to me, that's, I never thought, you know, could that be? I wonder. But that opens doors for science to really look at things they never thought ever existed.
Sure. There is a lot to the Webb Telescope. It is a very interesting. I haven't, it's been a couple of years. I did a little bit of a deep dive in in distraction, looking at the different telescopes. Like the mirrors, the mirror array in the Webb Telescope is something like, I think it's 2.5 times the size of the Hubble. Now, very similar in resolution, but very different in all of the different bands that it covers. Like, as you mentioned, it covers infrared, but ultraviolet, a number of different things along the way. They go into a lot of different directions with it, which is great. It's important for us to kind of see what's out there, to explore everything.
Well, not only that, is that if you really stop and think about it, we look at visible light and we think, well, that's all that's there. And then somebody came along with a prism and said, you know, all the colors of the rainbow are in that light.
Yeah.
And they said, say what? We couldn't see it. But it's there.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And now we're talking about infrared. We're talking about ultraviolet. We are talking about what we can see, plus X-ray, and all of these other rays that are out there coming from everything, including our own sun. And we're thinking, maybe, just maybe, you know, we're not all alone because there's so much out there more than what we even know there is.
There's tons of different information that's available. The amount of, visible light is just one small section of the entire spectrum, whether we're talking about gamma rays and X-rays, and on the, in the other direction, we've got the radio waves, some of the radio waves we put out and have been expanding throughout, well, a very, 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 very small section of our galaxy.
Oh, yeah. And you know, just going out there and, you know, and I think it's in South America, there's this great big huge radio telescope that's going out there and listening to what's going on out in the universe.
Yeah. It was in a James Bond movie. I know the one you're talking about. The one in the James Bond movie has actually been decommissioned. They started tearing that down about a year ago or so.
Yeah. But to me, I couldn't remember the name either.
Yeah. That's not important for today.
No. But that whole idea of being able to, I was probably in my 20s, 30s, something like that, when I read a book that described that light is made up of many, many different portions. Part of it is a ray, but some of it is particles. And I'm saying, how can they said, only light does that. And I'm saying, it took me a while to wrap my head around that one. So when I started to figure out what light is and reflective light. Now, I'm legally blind, so I get into light a whole heck of a lot here. But I like the idea that we're now starting to look at all those other types of rays of light and being able to perceive things that we haven't before. And I'm waiting for the day they say, we know what dark matter is, because you can't see it. And dark matter and dark light. And wait a minute here. If it's dark, does that mean we can't see it or does it not exist? And we know it exists, but we don't know what it is. And is it visible in light? Maybe, maybe not. I would like to know. Curiosity's got me going on
that. Sure, yeah.
But I personally think that light is one of the most, nature's most inventive tool was the eyeball to see with. Because what we see in light and what we perceive in light to the human being, on normal human beings, not one like me, is that light is that primary sense that we perceive things. And so going out there with the web and all those other telescopes, I can understand where we are not only breaking up light into its different aspects, but we're starting to understand how it's created and where it's going, because it goes on forever.
Yeah.
Or until it gets absorbed by something else.
So I looked up that one telescope that that came to mind. It is the, I'm probably going to butcher this a little bit, the Arecibo Observatory, and that's a radio telescope. It's actually in Puerto Rico. And that is actually the second largest overall radio telescope. It's the world's largest single aperture telescope. Up until there's a brand new one. It was just recently surpassed in 2016 after 53 years. Now, it also collapsed a few years after that. 2020 was when it collapsed.
Uh-huh.
And that was, you figure, you know, that lasted quite a while, though, nearly 60 years. And, it had a lot of different things that they did with that. Funded by the University of Central Florida.
Yep.
So.
I'm waiting for them to put a great big telescope.
Mm-hmm.
And a radio telescope and one like Webb and put them all on the moon.
The moon would be a very interesting place. I know there's some discussions of putting a telescope on the far side of the moon.
Yeah.
And that'll be an interesting discussion for a while. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Steve Geske. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment. You have a couple of those new carbon open frame racks from CyberPower, right?
Yeah, I love them. I configured a 25U to 40 inches deep, about twice as deep as a regular rack, and put more than a dozen peripherals in it.
You know, I saw your article about it. I can't believe it's not clutter.
And my 45U carbon rack, that's also 40 inches deep, will hold a ton of networking and control systems, the network video recorder.
Holy screwdriver, Rackman!
You're getting one of their gorgeous enclosed racks soon.
Oh yeah, the 24U. Bigger than their wall-mount carbon racks, but smaller than their tall boy.
Did you see what's happening with carbon on the CyberPower website?
Oh yeah, the promo, 10% off all their racks and rack accessories through the end of September. I put a link up at computertalkradio.com. ComputerTalkRadio.com. The website, ComputerTalkRadio.com, ComputerTalkRadio.com. Up there, I have a survey there for you. And it's going to ask you to give me a review of this radio show. Okay, no, I don't have anything like that. If you've been in any kind of service industry, you know that the system is almost a game these days. Good customer experience, and the customer is asked to provide a review. A bad experience? They're not. You won't hear anything about that review opportunity. And part of this is all because of digital discrimination. And we, you and I, are being dragged into this crazy just world about this. And, you know, one recent experience for me was, fill out the form online and mention my name, but please note it's spelled a little bit differently. We've got two Michelles here and mine is with a Y. Michelle with a Y? Okay, whatever. Anyways, technology has changed things. It used to be cards, then a call to an 800 number, and then came online. But now we have these little things that are at the restaurant tables. And what you and I are doing today is changing the world of statistical analysis, metrics, numbers, and not for the better. Customer service for your computer, survey, ride sharing, survey, my doctor's office. Yes, a survey. In a cold and callous world, these little surveys are going to change everything that we do, everything in our lives. For discussion purposes, for the next few minutes, one is going to be bad and 10 will be good. See, there's problems. And these problems will pop up when people who have a great day and a decent experience will give all 10s aces. I lean in that direction a lot. Other people might be in the middle of a bad day. They've got problems with the spouse, the boss, and whatever else that's going on in their lives, and nothing's gonna make them happy. So even a waiter who did everything right but was just a little slow with the water, ones. Or maybe it's not even the water. Maybe the waiter did nothing wrong, but it was the burger was too well done or not done enough. Whatever it is, I mean, in the numbers world, in the world of all of these different crunchings of in calculations and algorithms, we can solve for that. But some people may think that the survey is for honesty. They start going with fives, a few sixes or sevens, and a three or four because, yes, again, the burger, steak, or whatever was a little too well done. Okay. Data is shaping not just things that you might think about. It's shaping everything from your next Netflix movie, the advertising you're getting from Facebook. It is adjusting how every company out there operates. I've got a recent survey that I took at the office, and it's how do we all interact with each other, and how do I feel we're doing as a team, and so forth. And that is going to shape the future of our team. I'm very sure of that. But the big area I want to focus on is getting back to that restaurant, and it's not an analogy like I tend to do on a regular basis. This is a real practical experience here because it is going to change how that restaurant operates and which servers will get preferential treatment simply through the luck of what person gets their table. Today, we are finding out that the waiter or waitress who had a cranky guest enter in all ones, just, oh, this is horrible, horrible, horrible. Okay. They're not going to be spoken to. It's not like, you know, somebody went to the manager and said, hey, I've had a really bad experience here. And, okay, so it's because your burger is well done? Okay, well, we're sorry about that. No, today we're finding out that this anonymous little survey, well, that waiter or waitress, that server staff, instead, they're going to get just less shifts, less tables. And that actually is going to be a little bit more rough on them. You see, missing a shift hits their pocketbook. Think about the tip that you leave at the table and multiply that by 4, 5, or 6, or 10, however many people that they deal with in that shift. That's a lot of money. It used to be staff would get counseled and their performance would improve, or maybe not. But now, due to statistics and computers, the management doesn't have any idea other than those numbers, and they have no idea when they process those numbers because that cranky guest could have been weeks ago. There's this world of continuous process improvement, and there's many different names to it, Kaizen or Lean or 5S, and it speaks to measuring everything in so many different ways, but it was originally designed to work in areas of objective performance. How many people did you serve? How many drinks did you serve? How many plates, entrees, appetizers, desserts, add-ons, upsizings, upsells, and so forth? But now, it also includes how many people came in the door with an unbeatable bad attitude simply because they burned dinner at home and they have given up yet again and they're simply looking for sustenance. They're hangry. They're going to have a not great experience. Perhaps the guests have different expectations about service than the general world. We've all seen those people. We refer to them as Chads or Karens. Or perhaps there are guests who might be closeted racist or sexist against a great black male waiter. Some companies are now listing anything that is not a 10, anything that's not 100% perfect, as being a complaint. And as a reason to punish the servers, they list 5 is average, middle of the road. But what if you say the server is average? Worse yet are some of the questions that are being presented. Would you come back? Well, great server, but the price on the dinner was overpriced. How clean is the restaurant? Well, I didn't think about it before, but I see a napkin over there. Well, that napkin over there, 6 tables over, may not impact my server staff. It may be somebody else's fault. Would I recommend this restaurant to a friend? Wait a second. I'm not an evangelist for your restaurant. This is becoming prevalent everywhere, and I hate bringing it up because I know there are people out there that wish to see the world burn and would love to take this information and just blast away. I love computers, and I think we should use them more, but we need to work to find more meaningful data. See, your numbering system might be different than the next person. I've had employers give me perfect reviews, straight up 10s all the way across. And I've had others give me real world reviews to focus on opportunities for improvement, no matter how good I was doing. They still explained the details and they gave me similar increases in salary. Look, I don't have any kind of solution, any kind of answer to present here. I hope that someone out there does come up with a better solution, but it has to be one that is clearly objectives-based and doesn't punish because Bob and Barbara had a really bad day. Oh, and let's not even get started on this whole idea of tipping percentages that are defaulting to 20, 25, or 30% for takeout in an industry that's been spending years telling us that 15% was the norm for tipping unless it was absolutely excellent in this sit-down restaurant. Yeah, it's all going crazy with these computers, and I'm not happy with it. But maybe that's just me, Benjamin Rockwell of Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment.
Micro Center, home to all kinds of electronics and computer items, has over 20 locations across the country, and it's also available at microcenter.com. This is Benjamin Rockwell of Computer Talk Radio, and I live just a couple of miles away from my local Micro Center, and I've been shopping there for years. From Apple to Windows, they've got what you need. CPUs, got them. Screwdrivers and other tools, yep. Cables, televisions, scanners, projectors, cameras, they have it all. Micro Center is a place which fills your electronic needs. What are you looking for? Media centers, monitors, mice, MP3 players, media, modems, motherboards, memory? Those are just the M's. They aren't regional, but spread across our great land from Virginia to California. Each one is service and repair, in-store clinics, and business services, too. MicroCenter.com is their online store, a place where you can get your regular online ordering needs met. From the hobbyist to the professional, the brand name, or building yourself, MicroCenter is your resource. Check out MicroCenter.com today. MicroCenter.com.
Trevor's question is a good one. How does Google Maps know that traffic is building up ahead in real time? And, of course, Trevor reached out to me at computertalkradio.com, computertalkradio.com. You can do it as well. Feel free, scroll down to where it says contact us today. I will get back to you with answers to your computer questions and your technology concerns. Now, Trevor's question, how does Google... And we can relate this to Waze and all of these other different Apple Maps, whoever it is. How do they know that traffic is building up ahead in real time? And we have to start off with the idea that where cars are, okay, so we already know ahead of time that there are a bunch of cars that are going through a particular section of road. We know that is currently happening right now. And we can start adding to that, and we can say there's this much traffic that's going through here. And we know that when we get 5 of our customers going through here, that the traffic is going to slow down, and we can see that it's currently running, each of our five cars going through there is running 30 miles an hour. But then we start adding in some of the predictive analytics into this. And predictive analytics say that 5 miles prior to that location, going in that same direction, are five more cars that we have using our app, and five more that are 5 miles prior to that. So we start saying that those five cars are going to all arrive at particular points in time. We can look ahead and we can see that they're all going to arrive here. And at that speed level, it's going to start backing up more and more, and cars are going to slow down, and we start getting into that. But there's even more to this, because they can look at historical time data. They can look at a number of different things, because they've tracked all of these different bits and pieces of data as people drive through these different highways and byways and roads. And they know that when we get to 5 o'clock in the afternoon on a work day, the traffic has increased every year on this day, but also every week on this Friday, and so forth. And they start factoring in, okay, it's a holiday, and all of these different things. When you enter in your information, see, Google or Waze or whoever, they know where you're going, so they even know that you're going through that particular section of highway, and they may route you around to speed you along, and they're hoping that you're going to go around, but they're tracking those numbers. They're tracking those numbers, whether you're going to the north around a traffic jam or to the south around a traffic jam, or if you're being sent right through that traffic jam. So they're putting all of these different things in. They know how long each of these routes take normally. They know that if they move you around, all of this is going to kind of change. Now, here's one of the things that isn't so much of a big topic. Guess who owns Waze? Google. Yeah, that's right. Waze is owned by Google. So we can start thinking about all of these different things and who's tracking this data. And they are also looking at all of the other companies that are out there. What are they reporting? So they can start factoring in some of these different things together. That's basically utilizing third-party data. And that third-party data can include things like the transportation agencies, highway cameras, toll systems, and another third-party. That's you. When you report, hey, I see a crash here. I see a hazard here. Traffic is slowing down. That's automatic. I see cops here. So if there's a cop there, that actually will slow traffic down. And all of these different bits and pieces start coming together. This is all a very intricate crowdsourced series of information and data. All of your phones are sending this information, and whenever we're utilizing, I mean, we start looking at the different map apps that are in our cars. A lot of these different map apps are also sending certain bits and pieces of information, even if we're not actually utilizing the navigation feature. Yeah, I know how to get home. I know how to get home. I've been driving this same course for a year and a half. I don't need to plot my map my way home. I don't have to do that. But you know what? It already knows that. It's already figured it out. It also knows what shortcuts you're likely to take, and they start piecing all of this together. Some of this, admittedly, is through algorithms. I hesitate to use the idea of AI pattern recognition because it's been around a lot longer than that. But there's there is this blur that people forget between algorithms and AI. It is AI is artificial intelligence. It's a matter of algorithms that are so good that they appear to be intelligent. And it's able to figure out so many different things. They know certain drivers out there are slower drivers. They take that into consideration. They know that different people will set up things on their phones. They'll be just sitting there and watching the traffic, even though they're not driving. They're sitting there in that situation, and they're moving through that, perhaps on public transit or whatever else. And yes, they are taking even that into consideration. Look, our phone isn't just giving us the map, the navigation throughout the countryside. It is actually helping. Our individual phones are all helping to build that report that's going on behind the scenes. All of these different eavesdroppings on millions of tiny silent conversations from every single phone, every single car that's in motion along our highway. It's actually quite fascinating. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment.
Hey guys, this is Benny Rockwell. Most of us use video cameras nowadays, but what about those old movie films in the back of your closet? Well, let me tell you about Legacy Digital Productions. They specialize in taking your old memories on film, videotape, and slides and digitizing them to DVDs. Imagine Grandpa's old 8mm and 16mm films that are just sitting in a box getting old and fading away. Legacy Digital will clean and recondition those films, capture them digitally frame by frame, and then produce beautiful DVDs of your precious memories on long-lasting archive-quality discs. They don't use a projector, and your films can't be damaged in the process, the best available for families like yours. The final results are gorgeous. What better way to preserve those precious memories for future generations? Call right now, mention my name, Benny Rockwell, and receive a 30% discount on your order. Call toll-free 1-866-2-LEGACY. That's 1-866-2-LEGACY, 1-866-253-4229. And tell them Benny sent you. Your memories are priceless, so call 866-2-LEGACY now.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and how it's all evolving thanks to technology. And I want to first touch on something that we experienced, depending on how long it is you've been in the marketplace as far as searching for jobs. I remember years ago, I would go searching for a job and I would open up the newspaper. And then I found, yes, there were places online where you could apply for jobs. And yes, it slowly evolved. And we then got to an interesting point sometime in the mid-2000s where you would submit your resume and it would wind up being processed by a computer. These applicant tracking systems would go through and they would try to read your resume, put all of the information into the right spot and so forth. And that slowly evolved into many different directions. And today it is very difficult to land a job without touching one of these ATSs, applicant tracking systems. But the latest thing, the newest thing on the block is even worse. It is very cold to think about, cold-hearted to think about the idea of some machine processing your resume and giving you an instant response of going, yeah, you're not right for us. Excuse me? How do you figure? Especially if you've custom written the portions of your resume that need to apply properly to actually get that role. You've customized it. You're like, I'm 100% fit for this. And the computer goes, nope, don't think so. But I want to take you to that next level. And this is something we're starting to see people going through. We're starting to hear about this because we've gone to a new level with AI. The idea of putting out a computerized voice that sounds mostly realistic and a face that looks pretty decent. And it's all because of deepfakes that we can do this, and that technology can do this, employers can do this, and yet it's not what I would want to deal with. I mean, imagine this. You know, when you go to an interview, you're going to dress to impress. You may be sitting in your office or your living room, and you're looking into the webcam, but you're prepared for talking to a person, making an appeal to a warm, living human body. Now, imagine that you get into this, and it's no small talk. It's no real big, huge thing other than an AI platform that's sitting there and interviewing you. It's like auditioning for a role in a sci-fi film, except the stakes are your livelihood. And I don't understand why we're talking to machines instead of people. I get some of the different things that we go through along the way as we're dealing with AI, as we're working forward and trying to have it serve all of our needs for information. But there's a certain point when we will find empathy is going to be far better than this tech efficiency. Companies are turning everywhere to streamline hiring, and yes, it may allow them to process thousands of applications very quickly. But while it speeds up recruitment, it also breaks down that human connection that candidates value. I'll tell you, when I've ever looked for a job, I've looked for two sides to the equation. Am I a good fit? And is the company I'm going to work for, are they a good fit? Is this going to be a good cultural match for me? Or is this going to be something that I'm not going to benefit from? AI may be touted as objective, but then we get into other issues too. For instance, it's only as unbiased as the data that it's trained on. It can inadvertently give credit to certain people because they speak more clearly, even though they may not be quite as intelligent. It's going to give disadvantages to candidates that might have an accent, a vocal disability, or they may have an unconventional background. And this is going to start impacting all of the job seekers out there. Imagine an AI interviewer just repeating just weird things incessantly during your interview. It malfunctions. It may not even complete. We're starting to see where guys are showing up to, women are showing up to interviews, digital interviews, and the machine sits there for a second, freaks out, and then doesn't continue the interview. What's worse is there's no feedback that comes from any of these AI interviews. Without a human interaction, candidates are going to receive nothing. It's going to leave them in the dark about their performance, their prospects, and it's not going to connect them to the company. It's not going to leave them thrilled about the idea of working for some cold, faceless company that can't even afford to give 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 50, whatever it is, of time to see if this is a good match. For both sides, I fear for how this all will roll out. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment. Years ago, I found a web hosting company that fit my needs as a computer nerd, as a radio show host, and, well, a normal person. Recently, though, it became clear to me that it was time to upgrade. I had a choice between my old plan and the new one at 7 times the cost. It was that awkward point where I could choose between a sip of water or being dunked in a pool. I searched around, comparing the many options for someone like me. After looking for 3 weeks, there it was, site ground. In proper fashion, I tested their customer service, their knowledge, and their care, their willingness to do things the right way. The site ground salesman made sure that I didn't overbuy and get a 50-gallon bucket when all I needed was a 1-gallon bucket. The folks at SiteGround know WordPress, Joomla, and more. SiteGround.com, S-I-T-E, ground.com, for your web hosting needs. SiteGround. Mateo's question, why do we need to update software so often? And really, this is something that a lot of people ask, and I get it. It can be annoying. We have updates to our operating system on a very regular basis. In the Windows world, it is monthly. Over in the Mac world, it's not quite monthly, but there are many updates along the way. And we've got the same thing over in the Android operating system, the iOS for the Apple stuff. So we have to do this. And this is just those are just the basic operating systems. And software updates, whether it's the operating system or it's to Microsoft Office or whatever application we have, these are like regular health checkups for your computer. They fix known issues. They patch security vulnerabilities. And yes, quite frequently, they'll add in new features. First up, security patches. These updates often address security flaws that could be exploited by malware or are actively being exploited by the bad guys. So we have to have those security patches in place. Then there are bug fixes. All right, these resolve various known issues that may cause whatever you're running, whatever application it is, to crash, or perhaps it will behave poorly or unexpectedly. They keep things in line. Now, there's also the performance improvements that come along with some of these. Some updates can really enhance the speed and efficiency of your computer. One of the things I'm thinking about right now is the amount of drivers that come out, the frequency for drivers in regards to video cards. And the better drivers are going to make your system run better. Now, there's also compatibility issues that come along, and these updates are going to ensure that your software works well with new hardware or updated programs or anything like that. So this is already a good setup. But the best thing that I like, the thing that I keep an eye out for after every set of releases on a regular basis, I'm watching for the new features. And these new features can introduce new functionalities that might be something I might want to leverage. They increase the user experience. They improve the user experience. And they add to something that is there. And usually it's a much better thing all the way around that we install these. And it doesn't matter whether we're talking about Microsoft Office, we're talking about any of the Adobe products. We can be talking about games. Some of the gaming updates that we have seen over the years have been amazing updates where they take a game that was all right, and then they made it so much better because they were listening to us. They were paying attention to us. Yes, sometimes those feature updates are so big and huge they charge us again for it, but that's another story for another day. Look, regular updates are going to keep your system healthy and secure, much like a routine checkup maintains your personal health. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. We'll catch you next week.
Let me tell you about The Radio Factory, an exciting new venue for talk radio. It's the internet, the wave of the present. My name is Benjamin Rockwell, and I'm the host of a syndicated radio program, Computer Talk Radio, so I know the internet is here and now. Many of the hosts at theradiofactory.com have their own podcasts or radio shows across the country, but many people like the comfort of listening to their own special radio show at a specific time and day, much like we watch live television. The internet, as you're probably aware, is a powerful tool that allows The Radio Factory to deliver unique programming with far more variety than the windbags who are simply about contriving up viewpoints to get you riled up. Additionally, you'll find that many of the programs are shorter, giving more information in less time. Stick with theradiofactory.com and see how it evolves to keep you entertained, interested, informed, and above all, intelligent. After all, the Radio Factory motto is building your intelligence one talk show at a time. Theradiofactory.com.